Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the East Side Institute's Forum, New Yorkers at a Crossroads with Dr. Lenore Filani. First thing I want to do is ask people to please make sure your cell phones have been turned off. Thank you. My name is Carrie Loebman, and I am the Institute's Director of the Revolutionary Conversation Series and one of our international trainers. So one of my jobs at these forums is to make sure you're all in the right place and you know where you are. So you are not at NYU Law School. This is not constitutional law. Is everybody in the right place?
Yes.
Okay, good. You are, for the moment, at the East Side Institute, which was co-founded 35 years ago by Dr. Fred Newman and by our current director, Dr. Lois Holtzman. It was founded as a think tank, a laboratory, and an independent research center for the collection of organizations that now make up what we call the development community. So welcome. Since then, the Institute has emerged as an international educational training and research center for developing and promoting alternative and radically humanistic approaches in psychology, therapy, education, and community building. Chief among those is social therapeutics, an approach to human development and social change that relates to people of all ages and all life circumstances as social performers and creators of their lives. Created right here in New York City, social therapeutics is now practiced globally as social therapy, a non-diagnostic development-focused psychotherapy, and as a methodology with broad application in educational, cultural, health, and community settings. So this brings me to our speaker this evening, Dr. Filani. There are many ways to introduce Lenora, and since I've been doing it on the first Friday of December for the last 4 years, I know that, and I have to keep coming up with new ways. So she's a developmental psychologist, a community organizer, the primary Black leader of the independence movement here in the United States, the co-founder, together with Fred Newman, of the All Stars Project and Operation Conversation Cops and Kids, the first woman and the first African-American to be on the ballot in all 50 states, and I could go on. But tonight, I want to introduce you to her as a social therapist, which means telling you a little bit about social therapy. Fred Newman, the developer of social therapy, said, and I quote, "The ongoing social therapy group is a performance of revolution, a grouping of human beings doing what our unique species does periodically and in varying ways, create culture that is self-consciously developed." I've been a member of a social therapy group for many decades, different ones, and those sentences that he said are part of the reason why. In social therapy, week after week, we create and recreate culture. I wanted to give you a very quick example from my current group. We meet on Tuesday nights, which meant we met on election night. We were in a room with the door closed. We didn't know much of what was going on. But we also met the next week. And many people in the group came in giving voice to their emotional and political responses to the elections. And we discovered, actually, strangely to our surprise, and pretty quickly, and maybe others of you had this experience, that while many of us had known each other for years, and we might have assumed we knew each other's political beliefs, it turned out we had really different and very strong reactions to the election, and even more to each other. Saying we discovered these differences is kind of a nice way of saying that we pretty quickly started having fights with each other. But we didn't stop there. We're a pretty experienced social therapy group, and we have a lot of leadership in the room. One of the members of the group reminded us that whatever else we did that night, we were going to remember that we were intimate with each other and that our job as a social therapy group was to create culture. And we did. Slowly, excruciatingly, and incredibly beautifully, we created a conversation that was not about agreeing and disagreeing, but about getting to know each other and creating something new together. I've had the privilege to work with some fantastic social therapists over the years. Some of them are in the room tonight, but I will always consider Lenora Filani to be my community therapist. Now, Lenora used to practice therapy in an office. up in Harlem, at least I'm told. But she couldn't be contained within those four walls. So she left. She left the therapist chair behind to make the streets of New York, and frankly, this country, her practice. Lenora does therapy wherever she goes, at the All Stars Project, at PALs around the city, here at the Institute. Wherever she goes, she brings people together. You can see that by looking around this room. People who don't go together in a societal sense, white and black, rich, poor, and middle class, young and old, gay and straight, left and right. And she invites them to build something with each other and with her, to create new culture. And we've never had more of a need of that than now. So I want to end with another quote from Fred Newman. This is from 2000, from a chapter called The Performance of Revolution. Right now, and we could say this right now, our choices, the decisions we make, are conditioned by the dominant culture, by what people want and desire, as determined by that culture. Unless the mass can somehow be organized to engage in the process of transforming the culture, our wants and desires will continue to be circumscribed by the culture we are unwilling or unable to change. I go to Lenora for therapy because I think she is our best hope at organizing New Yorkers and Americans to transform and create a more humane and developmental culture. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Lenora Fulon.
I'm a diabetic, and as a result of that, I'm on dialysis 3 days a week. September 11th was one of those days. In fact, I was on my way to dialysis uptown. On that terrible day when the buildings collapsed, and it was, as for all of us, myself included, it was shocking. And I remember vividly the radio announcer. A woman announcer who was downtown screaming into the microphone as the power was falling. I continued on up to 86th Street, and no surprise, the waiting room was filled with my co-patients. Looking at the video screen and kind of collectively traumatized all of us. The nurses and doctors were doing their usual wonderful job, and indeed even more heroic and wonderful on a day like this. And I finally got brought into the care area, and wound up in a chair, as they could do, a reclining chair, and they started the hookup. And while in dialysis, you're hooked up to all kinds of machines, and readings on what's happening in your body. I don't even know all the readings. I make a point of not looking at the machines. Some people want to know everything about the machine. I don't want to know anything about the machine. Just do your thing and leave me be, is the attitude. But one of the things that the machines do is that they make the beep and they buzz for every different thing that goes off or goes on or goes right, they beep. So it's a chorus of beeps, beep, beep, beep. And there's 24 chairs in there. If you have 24 people in there, some will come in for 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it is, and there's people running around. It's kind of chaotic on the best of days, and this was the worst of days. And one of the things that they check pretty continuously is your blood pressure. Well, in general, I think throughout the entire center that day, blood pressures were high. Mine was sky high. Others were high. And when your blood pressure is high on dialysis, one of the things you want to know, it's important to know, is when will it be normal again? When will it be normal again? And in that context, on this, and indeed on other days when that happens, but on this day in particular, nobody had any difficulty in a very practical sense. Nobody had any difficulty in understanding what normal meant. In particular contexts, normal is completely understandable. I know there's a tradition, I'm part of that tradition, I've been a philosopher for years and years and years, I'm a postmodernist, I challenge things like the word normal, I say, what does normal really mean? I write papers about that and so on. But in this context, on that day, as in other contexts, on other days, everybody who's grown up and developed and lived in this society knows perfectly well what normal means. Indeed, on that particular day, just to finish the story before I go on, it never got normal. It stayed high. It stayed high. But I think the story is important because I don't want to give this, if you will, critique of normalcy as if nobody knows what it means. That's not true. You know that, I know that. We all have a fairly clear understanding of what's meant by normal in one context after another. But when the context change or changing radically, when the environment is transforming, then it becomes difficult, more difficult than ever, to comprehend what normal is supposed to mean. Normal, for the most part, the understanding of normalcy, whether it's blood pressure or whatever it might be, is relative to a conception of things, a picture of things, and a reality of things staying relatively stable. On this day, on that day, that terrible day, that tragic day, September 11th, things were profoundly destabilized. It was striking that even the staff, and I noted this even in the midst of my anxiety and my tenseness on that day up at my dialysis center, that on that day, people seemed, the nurses seemed, the doctors seemed, interestingly enough, less concerned with normalcy, with the pressure, because things were so destabilized. Well, I got through that day, as we all did, a difficult day, a long, long day. And I went back to work, as we all had to do. And I went back to work as a social therapist. A lot of people needed help. And I tried to make myself available to help people. Well, there's endless stories. I don't want to tell them all to you. Well, actually, I do want to tell them all to you.
Thanks, Carrie. Hi, everybody. Wow. It's a lot of people here. I've been listening to actually this tape for the last couple of days, and I both wanted to start off connected to Fred. And also, I think the issue that he explores in this conversation about normalcy, what's normal, is a very important one, and I think people are experiencing that, different people in different ways, some relative to the presidential race, and whatever thoughts people have about that. I have thoughts, I'm going to share them, you should share yours. And also because many of the people in this room, I'm leading, and others, I'm leading a fight in opposition to the closing down of the NYCHA housing projects, of which 650,000 people live in. And that should seem abnormal that anybody's even considering that, but we definitely seem to live in a time where normality in ways are being challenged. I'm not even saying that that's a bad thing. It depends on what the normal thing is. So welcome. I want to take a moment to thank Carrie, Mary, and Gwen. I think of them as the awesome threesome. They gave me enough suggestions for this talk. I could have written like 3 books. It's very helpful. Anyway, I want to thank them for their ongoing input in the shaping of this presentation over the years. I deeply appreciate your sensibilities, your smarts, and how very giving you are to this process. And, of course, thanks to all of you for coming out. Since the election, I've had several conversations with people who expressed their panic and their concern over the election of Donald Trump. I didn't vote for either him or Hillary. I actually voted for Jill Stein, because if you're black, you think you have to vote because people fought for you. So I went and I voted. I had no expectations she would or could win. And now with whatever she's doing with the recount, it seems to me, it's in cahoots with Hillary Clinton, so that raises a whole host of issues. I'll just leave it there. I have a strong reaction to the hysteria of a lot of liberal people, I don't know if that's a fair description, to the election of Trump. I don't know what he will or won't do, but one thing I know is that his base is a segment of the American people, and that Americans voted for him. And from where I come from, that's to be respected. And while a lot of the attacks focused on Trump are often expressed because people are saying, we don't know what he's going to do, I must share that as an African-American woman and progressive, I do know what the Clintons have done, Bill as president and Hillary silently by his side, that has had a devastating impact on the poor communities of our country. The Clinton dynasty's tough on crime policies in the 1990s led to the creation of the largest prison system ever within the United States, and to the mass incarceration of 1.2 million poor black and Latino men. And it is a move that has contributed to serious disaster and dysfunctionality amongst America's black and Latino poor. Years ago, I used to take trips to upstate prisons to speak to the inmates. After a while, I had to stop because it was so upsetting and so heartbreaking. And it further organized me to help build a movement to respond to the inequities that landed all of those people in prison. President Obama wanted the black community to vote for Hillary. I know this is provocative. I'm going to be as provocative as I can be. I can. Provoked. President Barack Obama delivered an impassioned plea to the African American community election night to help stop Donald Trump, saying he would consider it a personal insult to his legacy if black voters didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton. He also addressed the Congressional Black Caucus, where he said the same thing. I was personally insulted that President Obama thought that he could say that to people, not as simply a suggestion. He has the right to make suggestions, but who gives a damn if he's personally insulted? People have the right to vote for whom they are. It's like a strong move. And obviously people didn't pay any attention to him. The black community's response to this appeal on the part of President Obama and to Hillary Clinton's candidacy and to the Democratic Party was demonstrated in this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful way. 1 million fewer blacks voted in this election than did in the last election. And what they were saying to Hillary and Obama and the Democratic and Republican dynasties and whomever else is, we don't have to do this way. We're going to say what it is that we want, what we need, and we even like President Obama, so he's leaving, sort of. However, we just won't do this. I feel so proud of them. I am, like, really, really excited. Jacqueline Selly, president of independentvoting.org, had the following to say, which I wanted to share. She said, key to a Clinton victory strategy was high turnout among African American voters, a mainstay of the Democratic Party coalition. However, not unlike what white blue-collar Americans face in the dislocations caused by globalization, the poverty and unemployment in inner city communities has become more harsh and relentless. Political loyalty to the Democratic Party has become a more strained. A third of younger black voters identify as independents, and in plain English, Hillary Clinton isn't Barack Obama. Exit polls appear to indicate that 1.3 million fewer black voters cast ballots this year. While Clinton polled 80% of those voters, Obama had polled 93% in 2012 and 95% in 2008. That over a million fewer African Americans came out to the polls was part of the death blow to the Clinton coalition. It's worth noting that the volatile coalition of blacks and independents, we sometimes call it the Black and Independent Alliance, which raised up Obama in 2008, deserted the Democratic Party in 2016. Whether and how it regroups and reemerges is a poignant question for both communities and a challenge for their leaders as well. I want to shift for a moment to speak about another issue. Your mayor, Mayor de Blasio, and the city, others, are attacking people who live in New York City public housing, who live in the projects. It's estimated to be more than 600,000. The destruction of public housing in most places, the blowing up of them, has occurred in numerous cities all over this country. They just blew them up. Chicago, if you go to Chicago and see where poor people of color are living, it just breaks your heart. It looks like something out of the 1920s. Atlanta, Newark, St. Louis. And it's basically resulted in people living in very poor housing in very poor neighborhoods. The reason for the destruction has been crime. Black people and Latino people are violent people, according to this. And there are shootings and things that people do. What they never talk about is poverty. So they focus on the criminality of it, basically, so they can do whatever they want to do because they set people up as the bad people and they need to be controlled. They don't talk about how people literally want to live or have to live their lives. If they want to change the crime, they should impact the poverty. They should send our kids to decent schools and give their families the opportunity to be a part of America in a real way. One thing that was noted during the recent election was that the issue of poverty, poor Americans, was never addressed. At a moment when millions of Americans, not just Black and Latino, are living in deep poverty. In the ongoing critiques of the residents of poor neighborhoods, poor communities, poor schools, and school performance, people talk about those things, but they never say this has to do with poverty, that America is poor, that America may be the richest country in the world, but a lot of people live in poverty here. The absence of acknowledging the challenges of poverty with the poor and how it impacts their lives has a devastating impact because, like with crime, being identified as a criminal, people just fill in the blank. They won't engage. A lot we haven't been forced to engage, that we have a high poverty rate, especially among some populations, but also the growing rate amongst the white poor. They never talk about white poor people. Even in spite of the fact that they've been talking a lot about the overabuse of drugs in the white communities, they're not talking about where Hillary lives. They're talking about people, normal, ordinary people, who are struggling with their lives, their kids. When I ran for president in 92, we went to New Hampshire. And it was like being in Harlem before they built all these buildings. It was street signs, remember that guy? It was amazing. And we bonded immediately with poor white people because it was so tremendously upsetting. And the second grade class endorsed me as their candidate for president. So this is no little thing to ignore. The fact that we don't talk about poverty, we should be forced to. One thing that I often try to share with people is going back to the issue of crime, is that it reminds us of the ghettos which housed Irish, Italian, and Jewish immigrants in the 1930s and 40s, and a lot of the crime decreased immensely with the assimilation of these immigrant populations into America's mainstream, which among many things included access to livable wages. For the most part, the African-American, the Latino, and to some degree the Asian populations have yet to be integrated into the mainstream of this country. We built it, we clean it, we do all kinds of things relative to it, but we are not the bulk of us, the part of this. So we see this in the current locations of the New York City housing developments, and with the growth and gentrification of the city, poor people need not apply. There is a move on the part of the city to do a serious land grab of housing land with no plan and nowhere for people to be relocated other than to shelters and the streets. According to your mayor, 60,000 people are on the street, so did he go out and count them? It's unclear what the numbers are. They're probably many, 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 many more than that. We run youth programs. I have kids calling me every other week and saying they just got evicted. So those numbers are high. 60,000, even if it's there, it's like devastating. And I listen to the young people and their families, their parents, speak about what it means to lose your house. What does it mean to lose housing? What, how do you like translate that into some kind of understandable language and emotion? What's it mean to have to sleep on a cot in a room with 50 strangers while your family thinks any minute anything could happen to them? What, a lot of times when you think of homelessness, it's a word, it's not, you know, it is what it is, but it means something. It's devastating. And part of what I've worked to do with the young people, their families, is to help them continue to grow and develop in the midst of crises. Because they have every right to just lose it, and that doesn't make it better, and you can't even blame them. But the least we can do is to create opportunities and places for them to grow and deal with and speak to these issues as we organize them to fight in opposition to it. We're in the midst of a petition campaign against NYCHA, the New York City Housing Authority. And we have one of my favorite tenant presidents with us, Carmen Quinones. Stand up, Carmen. She and I both know something about fighting. Anyway, we've collected close to 10,000 signatures, and we'd like to collect another 10,000 from people out in the streets. Many people in this room have participated. And they speak to folks about the fact that this is happening. And we started doing this, I don't know, 2 months ago. I can't remember, 6 months ago. We started it at some point. And it's broken through. They were planning on doing this with no talk, no dialogue, nobody saying nothing. You turn on the TV, New York One has all these extensive conversations with the people who you all elected, and nobody speaks to this. But bit by bit, it's coming to the fore. And as I say to people, no matter who I'm talking to and what we're trying to accomplish at the moment, I have no idea, because people say to me, well, how do you know this is gonna work? Well, I don't. It's not even clear to me what work is. Maybe all the wealthy people in the city will move out and give the homeless people their homes. I don't know. I mean, that would be fine for me. I do not have a plan. I don't like cynicism, and I don't think you work on things because you know you're gonna get to wherever you're going in some way. You don't need a formula. I don't know, black people were enslaved. We're not. Dr. King put his life on the line along with other folks to fight for the civil rights. People have fought for gay rights. People have fought for human rights. We don't know. But if that's the requirement for responding decently to a foul situation and a foul system and an attack on poor people in this country or in the world, then I don't want any part of it. I don't care that we don't know. So we have over 10,000 signatures. If all of you take 100 petitions, we could get beyond that really quickly. And we have them, I'm not joking. We've produced 3 community meetings that in total, I guess about 1,500 people have come out to. We marched in the African American Day Parade twice. We took it over in Harlem. It was phenomenal. And lots of people have come forward. People in the housing developments are playing a key role. from petitioning to letting people know to coming to our regular meetings that we have once a month at the All Stars Project. We also went to this event. Shola Olatoye is the president of NYCHA, and she's a monster. She has no sensitivity or sensibility. Like, I just want to shake her, except I go to jail. About her distance from what's coming out of her mouth. She just says these things. And we went to this meeting a few weeks ago, and there were like 1,000 people from the housing projects in Brooklyn. And when you go to a meeting, when they give you a card for you to write your question on, it's because they don't want you to ask your question. Or you don't even know if any of the questions they ask come from the card. So everybody wrote the question, and she got up and was doing her performance. I don't even know what she was talking about. And a woman in the crowd said, "This isn't what we want to talk about. This is what we want to talk about." So then, you know, she said, "Sit down, this wasn't person." And this phenomenal thing happened. The people just started yelling, "Let the woman speak." And then I knew I was in the right place. It was so wonderful. And Jamela, who's this quiet little lady over here, was one of the first ones. It was beautiful. And they took the meeting. And a couple of programs that work with homelessness, I spoke to a couple of people, and they said, "Wasn't that meeting a mess?" I said, "A mess? It was the best thing. It was orgasmic. It was wonderful." A mess? It was so great. It's always great to have people stand up and say, "No, you're not doing this to me. You're not doing it to her. You're not doing it to us. You're not doing the community." Anyway, I don't even know if I've gone over my time. But one thing I wanted to say, because I feel upset about this, is the NYCHA people, Shola and her crew, the mayor, they're tricky. So one of the things they came up with that they announced, they've been talking about it, but it was on TV yesterday, is that they're going to ban smoking in housing. So, I mean, I don't smoke. I have no problems with the other people smoking. But what they're really planning to do is people are going to start turning people in. These people are so viciously evil. And I want us to get to all of the housing developments by next Wednesday. and let people know, just forget about this. Who cares? If you think you're going to lose your house, smoking's the least of it. Let the people smoke, goddammit. They're worried about what's happening to them. This is so much a trap. So, am I supposed to talk about anything else?
No, you're supposed to see if they want to ask you questions.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I love this meeting. Anyway, we're not going to abandon the people in the housing development. And if you were touched, in a good way, by this, you should sign up. We have, and you should take petitions. They need you. Dr. King needs us to do this. So, questions? Yes?
I wonder if you had an eyeball peeled, I guess, during the Bloomberg administration and all the changes that terminated rent stabilization and rent control as we knew it, which was established, I believe, after World War II to protect low-income veterans returning from war. It just seems like this city has become a city of greed, and everything has turned around to favor the landlords, you know, and not protecting the balance of, you know, the whole total ecological picture, you know, what we are and, you know, our history, you know. I just keep thinking they tear down, you know, little buildings and build these huge things. Why don't they build something in keeping with the context of what we have already, you know, and you know, preserve the city for all of us?
Mm-hmm. Because they are not interested in all of us. I mean, no, it's scary. It's very disconcerting to walk into neighborhoods in the city that people have lived in for years or been connected to in some ways, it's very upsetting. And the developers have the support of the politicians, the political, your city council person isn't on the front line because I know most of them. These people are not out there speaking. They should like throw their bodies up against the buildings and say, you can't do this here. They should do some leading. And they're not doing that. And it's so inhuman. I can't even often find the words to express what's happening to people, what these people are willing to do. So it's a power issue. And they are exerting their power. They're not asking you, can I build this building here? You wake up and one day it's there. If we don't figure out a way to work together on these issues, and we've had a lot, we go into all kinds of communities and we've asked people who aren't being impacted by this, who don't live in NYCHA, to participate. And then there are also people who are worried about the unaffordability of where they're living, who don't live in NYCHA, who've also joined in to do, you know, we just went to this meeting last night to do this. But this is a big deal, and it's a political deal. We have to figure out how to make a political statement about this while dealing with the, I think, tremendous upsetness of people in the city. There is no, this is like being in the Twilight Zone. So I don't think it's understandable in some ways because it's so screwed up. But what we have to understand is if we want to do something about it, we have to work together as New Yorkers and actually people around the country, because you're doing it all over the country.
I didn't quite understand. You said that de Blasio was dissolving the NYCHA public housing, had a plan to do so?
Yes.
That's outrageous.
That's the very point. Yes, and the evictions, they're doing a lot of evictions that, you know, it's ridiculous. But it's, yes, he obviously made deals with the developers. That's what the newspapers say. I didn't say it. Plus, we protested against him a couple weeks ago outside of a Crane's breakfast where a lot of business people were at. He's not supporting you. He's not supporting the community. He isn't supporting people who live in housing. And people know it. And every time I say this to a Democratic elected official, they say to me, well, it started under Bloomberg. I supported Bloomberg. Bloomberg ran as an independent. Bloomberg has not built these buildings because we would have run he had to be responsive in a way that de Blasio feels like he doesn't. A lot of this, I don't know what the backroom deals were, but in terms of what we're currently seeing has happened since the liberal de Blasio became mayor of the city. And he's acting like he does, I guess he's so high up in the air in his airplanes, he doesn't know what's happening on the ground, but he's not responding. And we should really respond to that. Alicia.
Hi. For those of us that are planning to take petitions with us, can you give us a couple of talking points as we are talking to people outside that, you know, will help us to gather signatures?
There are probably 50 people in this room who could do that.
I guess around that point, the question I had was, you mentioned the poverty levels. I was kind of wondering what the numbers were. She mentioned about the poverty levels currently in the city being quite high, and I was just wondering what they were compared to 10 years ago or, you know, historically, if you happen to know that.
I think they're higher. I don't know.
To the density of, I don't know, you know what I mean? It's hard to know.
Well, also, there are more people in shelters, there are more people in the streets, and the numbers are growing, and people are poor. I don't know, you know, if it's 50% of the population or whatever, but it's pretty high, and people are frightened. Also, that's not just for poor people. Actually, I thought we were in the midst of an economic crisis in some ways, and when you are, the impact of that on the people who have the least is even...
Yeah,
more deadly.
I mean, I'm sure it's there. I'm just.
Just in terms of the.
Yes.
What we say to people. So, a lot of people, many of us, have been at the housing developments talking to people, and also talking to people who just walk by, who don't live in the NYCHA developments. And I think the one thing is you want to tell people why you're there and what's happening. And a lot of people have heard something about privatization of public housing and the fact that they are building private buildings, developments, on NYCHA property, and they've done that the people who live in NYCHA housing cannot afford. So it's a way of isolating poor people right where they live. And so just talking about the fact that the mayor's plan is called Next Generation NYCHA, and it's what we call it from the meeting last night is Next Gentrification of NYCHA. so you just talk about that, and somebody asked about talking points. A lot of people have been discussing this, but people know about it. You want to talk about the importance. Public housing was built for the poor, and they're privatizing it and bringing in private developers. They're subsidizing private developers for this. They're not giving the money to the public housing, which needs repairs and needs so much support and so forth. So those are some of the
And we also have talking points.
Yes, we have talking points. And the people in public housing do not support this. The 650,000 people have no voice. They've completely shut them out, which is really a democracy issue.
Carmen, then.
I just want to break it down a little bit more for you guys. I'm the president of Douglas Houses, and I represent 5,000 residents. And you must excuse me because I'm not really feeling all that well. But I thought it was important to be here. This is not a joke anymore. People are living in conditions with mold, mildew. I have to definitely, half the time, go straight into these apartments. And I'm getting sick. We have elderly people that do not have family, or they have a home attendant. These people are being put out. With just like it's nothing. They're building luxury housing on land that's not theirs. It's not theirs. You know, we sweated years to build what we have. People have died for what we have. This is not only a NYCHA problem. There are people in stabilized buildings all around the world that are being affected also. So this has to be a movement of everyone. I just want you to know that we need you guys like never before. Ms. Villani has been on the front lines for a long time. But the time has come, if you have grandchildren, I got 18 of them. Where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? Next gen, next nothing. There's no next gen. They are literally demolishing these houses for the rich. I don't know about the middle class, because in a little while, middle class ain't going to mean nothing either. We are having a march on February 15th at City Hall. I hope to see some of you guys there. Mm-hmm. Just have a little bit of heart.
Yes, yes, and yes. Just, you have
stand
to
up.
Yell.
Okay.
Stand up.
Stand up.
I started a food pantry in my home because there are a lot of people that do go through hungry situations, night situations, where they don't have food for their children. I live in a two-bedroom apartment with six people. I sleep on a mattress underneath my twin's bed. I've taught my children to go to school, to do the right thing. My kids are in college. Two of the girls, they are 20-something years old. We have not been able to get a big apartment. They work in a school system. They teach. My son works. My other son works. I teach them the right thing. They take our money. Everyone's income has to go towards housing, a percentage. But yet we have to sleep with mattresses. My boys, they're grown men. My oldest is 27. He has to sleep on one bed. The other one has to sleep on another bed. The other one has to sleep on the floor mattress underneath the bed. And we have a whole hallway with food bins. It took us 2 years to fight for kitchen cabinets.
Teach.
And that's what started in the hallway, which we started saying, well, we'll feed the people who are hungry as well. We live in a mold-infested apartment, which took us on a journey because my daughter kept being in ICU, and ACS came and removed her from my home, which that did devastation with my twins because she could not stay with us because she kept getting sick from mold, and they said, well, we can't leave her here. But then they told us at one time, you have to close down the food pantry because the mold had traveled to three areas of the home.
What's your name?
Charlene.
Charlene, where do you live?
I live on Pitching.
On who?
Pitching.
On the Lower East Side. Okay, can I stop you? And would you make sure that you could we connect before you leave? And thank you so much for, this is deep, sharing it. And it's actually, it's common. Let's give her a round of applause. I told you, yes. I don't
good really. Evening. My name is Miguel. I come out of Drew Hamilton houses up in home. And I run a program. It's called Off the Block. And my emphasis is trying to give the people in the community, allowing them to see something different than what they see in that little square area. And my thought has always been that, I mean, my fear is that the housing itself, NYCHA, it creates the atmosphere or the mentality of not wanting to do better for yourself. And I say this because they do it in, they have people within housing afraid to work to achieve anything better because if I do, my rent will go up too high for me to be able to live there. And it gets to the point that, and I say we, that we don't take care or we need to find a way that we can better learn to take care of what we have. Because my thought is that if you're coming by and you're looking at where I'm living, I'm not taking care of it, it almost kind of like says, okay, they don't want it, we'll take it.
Okay, go ahead, say your last sentence.
And so I've been working really hard to try to change the thought process or, you know, having us better take care of what we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that does, first of all, I don't agree, but you have the right. I think that people have all kinds of opinions about people in NYCHA because the other thing that comes with living in a housing development is that people think they can have all kinds of opinions about them. I grew up in a housing project in Chester, Pennsylvania. The housing was built all over this country because we were living in slums. And people lived in those houses because we haven't quite broken into corporate America. We don't run this country. We're not Donald Trump. We're not even the people who work for Donald Trump. And part of what I think, which I have a strong opinion, but I'm not going to yell at you. No. I think people are taught to relate to poor people in a way that if white middle-class people or black middle-class people did anything close to what you were saying, it would be perfectly fine. I don't really care. I think people live the lives they want to live, and that has absolutely nothing to do with this attack. These people are saying to the people in our communities, you are a piece of shit. And we don't care if you make your bed or you don't, you send your kid to school or you won't. They come up with rules. If your kid has been imprisoned, they can't come back home and live with you.
That's right.
The inhumanity, yeah, of how we are related to is outrageous. We built this country. And Dr. King did not give us a list when he was very, very, very fervently fighting for housing for poor black people and others in the 1960s. He didn't give us, you have to pass the good guy list. So I'm going to fight. I don't care if people do everything that they're not supposed to do. They have the right to live. And I also think that the housing development people who live in housing has is so viciously anti-poor. I mean, people probably who are middle class do things that are outrageous. Who gives a shit? This is a human rights issue. This is deeply, it's got to do with the continuation of the civil rights movement and the fight for people to live decent life. And are they perfect? I got kids, they're not perfect. So I hear you and I don't care. I want you to fight for them. It doesn't matter. We should just say we need housing for the poor. Okay,
so many working people in there.
Could people ask, yes, and a lot of people worked.
A lot of good working people.
Could you give me like 3 sentences? Go.
Thanks for discussing this because everybody's help is needed. I recently became a member of CBH, which had the meeting last night, Community Voices Heard, in East Harlem. I live in Queens, but I got involved in East Harlem because of my experience with homelessness and the rezoning plan for East Harlem will cause homelessness.
Yes.
If the mayor is talking about reducing homelessness in New York City and supporting the developers in East Harlem, something's wrong. And what's happening is in East Harlem is happening everywhere. We're asking two of our demands, $200 million for repairs at NYCHA.
No, $1 billion.
It has gone up, $1 billion.
We ain't stupid.
We also want housing for people. Most of the people in East Harlem make $23,000 or less.
No matter where they live, yes.
So we're asking for housing for that population because most of the neighborhood is that population.
Right.
Which means that the building that's going on will disperse the population, which is a common tactic. I think what's happening in East Harlem is related to what's going on in North Dakota.
I agree.
So I encourage you to get involved in this with Dr. Polanyi's help because it is crucial. Thank you.
Thank you. That was perfect. Yeah.
Good evening. I have a question with regard to your social therapy, is that correct terminology? What I'm wondering about is with all this that's happening, there's also the mental health of the individuals that are there in addition to the social services that are being provided and the fight for just housing and your basic abilities. What efforts are being made in that area? I'm just quickly thinking about being from Baltimore and remembering the mass exodus of the late 90s.
Yes.
Being one of those kids that moved to Atlanta and now having family that's there, you can't just move anywhere now because we're having the same thing. And apart from just having food to eat, it's the psyche. So I'm just wondering what's happening in that regard to help. Well, not to help us journey with the people that are there, because I don't want to say help like it pays it, they're not. But not assist, but sir, be in there with them in that way to help them from the mental health perspective.
Well, that's, thank you. You want to clap? Carrie wasn't kidding when she said that I was a community psychologist or whatever she described me as. Social therapist. I think that subjectivity is a huge thing. And I think that one of the ways in which people who are in crises grow is that they have to participate in addressing and engaging the thing that they're in crises about. And so we do lots of meetings. People call a lot. They're on the streets petitioning. They feel supported. You have to participate in the process. And that's been of tremendous value. And then sometimes you just have to sit down and cry.
Yeah.
And weep, because this stuff is deep and it's real and it's very, very painful. So I agree, and we have a community in many ways that is very much aware of therapeutics and the importance of it. And a lot of our people have never been anywhere near it. I mean, that's why the kids are so angry, because there's so much stuff going on that they never ever get to talk about. And the same thing with their parents and with just regular people. So we got that. Part of what it means to, in a way, it's developing in the midst of crises. Because you could go in a lot of different directions, and you can keep growing if you're supported and people aren't critiquing you. This is very critical. Harry?
Yeah. One of the things that is helpful, at least, and maybe for others, is one of the things that's helpful in getting at what's going on is to look at the logic of the people who are implementing this. And the real estate community looks at Amsterdam houses behind Lincoln Center and says that the land is underutilized because that land could be producing X amount of profit, and if it's devoted to public housing, it's not doing that. And in their mind,
that means something.
The moral issues, yes. That's it. And that's going on all over the world. It's going on in terms of the relationship between the Germans in the European Union and people living in Southern and Eastern Europe. And if you have an economy in a world that's run on the basis of that concept of value, then these things are going to continue to happen, and they're happening at an accelerating rate. So one of the encouraging things, in addition to this NYCHA fight, is the people in England who voted to withdraw from the EU, because they said, we don't know what's going to happen. We're not going to do this way, because this doesn't address our understanding of democracy or how we should be living. And something like that happened in the United States with the rejection of the Clintons. Now, we don't know what Trump is going to do, and he's obviously not the best messenger. He's not Jesus. He's not Pope Francis. But he said, look, we don't go along with this idea of value, and we don't want a world that's run on that basis. So we're a part of that, and that's a good thing.
All right.
Martin Luther King had a lot of support from the white working class.
And middle class.
He might have been murdered because he was really on the cusp of consolidating that. And Barack Obama got a lot of votes from white working class in the Rust Belt, and in a way, you could say the swing vote was not just black people not voting for Clinton, but the white people who had voted for Obama did not vote for Clinton. Now, you started off about normalcy, and you're saying about having to have some respect for the people, the constituency that voted for Trump. Now, it seems to me that his message, Make America Great Again, was exactly about that. He was saying it isn't normal. Now, his idea of normal, he would like to be considered normal. But he actually won the election on exactly that point of saying it's not normal, and I'm going to do something about it. Whereas Clinton was saying everything's okay, let's continue Barack Obama's legacy, we recovered from the recession, blah, 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 blah. So my question is, you know, what is the type of message that could bring back leadership of the black community of progressives to having a message that could unite the Trump constituency around a real message about, yeah, things aren't normal, but there's a different way to go with this. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of organizing message that can build the, as we said 20 years ago, black-led, multiracial, progressive movement?
Mm-hmm. That's great. Give him a round of applause. I like that. I'm reading this book called White Trash, and I want to shove it down the person's throat who wrote it. I mean, it's so vicious, that one and another one that came out. And I actually, I meant to write about it in my talk, but I left, I forgot a million things that I wanted to say in my talk. But it is so profoundly upsetting. And I think about the people in Staten Island, and I am going to take Sarah and another, and a black person, and we're going to go to Staten Island. I'm going to talk to the people in Staten Island about this. I think that what you're saying, I mean, the country has abandoned the white poor. And I think that they're, like everybody else, left, center, and right. And we have to go find those people who are movable. But the fact that, like, people can't write a book quite like this about black people. Like, they couldn't write a book about black trash. We would be all over it. I mean, people would respond to it, including white people. And they probably, there are a lot of people who may think that, but it's a harder book to write because I think what we've done in this country, and there has been some responsiveness to the viciousness towards us. But to take liberties like that with poor white people is so upsetting. And I don't want to participate in that any more than I want people to participate in doing that relative to our community or any community. And I think we have to figure out a way to make that connection. That is so important. And the communities of color have to lead it. We have to go and say to whomever, who hangs out in Staten Island, and who, wherever else. I also realize, because I've done a lot of work with cops, I run the best program in the world. And so if I call the white cops up and say, look, I need 5 white cops to be here by 3 o'clock and it's 2:45, they get there. So I'm totally impressed. And I'm going to meet, because they're white working class. And a lot of the things that they're struggling with are just these kinds of things. And they have families. So I was thinking earlier about doing a meeting with them. But it's true. Like, nobody should be able to get away with that book. You should just read it. It's terrible. It's, like, outrageous. So I agree. Yes.
Because I read a book that was outrageous, too, and you said there was a second book.
Stand up, I'm sorry.
Hillbilly yes. Elegy.
Yeah.
I'm so infuriated.
Good. They actually reference this book in that. Well, that's how it's very self-conscious and very deliberate, because it's a way to split the white and black and Latino, the working class communities of this country. Mm-hmm. But it's vicious. It's unacceptable.
Well, it's
so we're gonna work on this together. Okay. It's what?
It's very unfortunate, because I do a lot of networking for my work and for my passions. And that networking takes me through varying degrees of wealth, from the uber wealthy to, in fact, election night, I'll share with you, I call it in the lion's den. Joking, I hope I'm not offending any Clinton voters here.
But no, you could say we like you.
I'm told one of Hillary's top female individual supporters. Okay? Met her at the airport when she came in, election night, so on, at her home, and they were just devastated, of course. I couldn't really speak while I was there. And they were ranting a lot about all of these, white America, the deplorables, exactly. And I also had networked through a lot of female entrepreneurial groups, white female, a lot predominantly white in that environment. It is somewhat mixed, but it's largely white. And kind of the same thing. But also, even there's a South Asian entrepreneurial group that I networked through as well. All females. These are all females. Kind of same concept going there. And just unfortunate misinformation. I just felt so bad that the media, in particular, took such an issue. That was the most disgusting thing to me of the election, actually.
Which thing?
The issue of race and equality, something that is an issue, mm-hmm. that has been an issue for so many years, mm-hmm. and made that the focus of this election, mm-hmm. disgusted me, really.
Well, I think the best thing that Hillary did was to call people deplorables, because then you didn't have to explain to people what that there was something wrong with her. Like, you can't, no, you can't, you can't. I've run for office, I ran for president, I was like, you know, nowhere near able to win. There's a way you have to talk about the American people. And I don't even think you should do it offline. But that she is so distant from decency and from offending people, I mean, it's amazing. So to me, that took care of that. That was phenomenal, because I thought, like, the American people are going to do something about this. And they did. Yes. Yell at me.
My name is Jonathan. I'm from New Jersey. I believe everything's been talked about here, and what people are talking about, bringing people together. And my friends and I have been having very deep discussions on what we can do about it, because after the Trump election, it was just a disaster. And, you know, I'm a computer technician, you know, but I've been involved in politics for a very long time. After that, I'm like, it's got to be something that we can do. So what we decided to do, that I'm running a campaign for New Jersey governor next year, and as an independent, because both parties...
Okay, we like independents.
A revolutionary campaign. We've been all over the place. We're starting small, but we're going to go and talk directly to the people, because really, I mean, you just got to cut through all of it. And you know, that's why I'm saying, you know what, we stick together and we can get everything we need to done.
Okay, great. The public housing in Newark ain't doing too well either, so people need a lot of support. So in between running for office, you all should go there and help build the community. That's important. Other questions and thoughts? Are you all riled up, and are you going to do everything I asked you to do?
Yes.
Yes.
So in this whole post-election fallout, there has been... So in this post-election kind of fallout and navigating all of these issues and emotions, there's this huge gap in, I guess, just people, like people yelling. There's so much hatred that I feel kind of pulled towards the side of the very marginalized groups who are being very vocal now, the more liberal side, I guess, that there's nothing, the narrative that's being woven is that, well, if you put this man in office, you're against all of us. Mm-hmm. And that's something I don't, and not enough people know how to navigate or kind of push back against and say, well, wait, there's another way to talk about this. Like, we can't go at it from that point, because that's not fair at all. And
so,
either which
so
way,
can you do
fair,
that?
I don't know.
Well, say it and see what happens.
Well, I've been trying, but I feel
what happens?
This, I don't know, like, it's not, it feels like I'm the only fish swimming upstream and I can't connect, and I think a lot of us feel this way. We can't connect with the people who are doing that.
So then you should bring those people together, and then we should sit down and do something. I don't think you should sit in a room and bam your head up against the wall. None of us know the actuality or the reality of what the right thing is. We do what we have to do, and people have the right to have all kinds of opinions, even if we think they're the dumbest opinions in the world. But you should work with people who are moving with you, and there are enough of them. You don't have to convince people, you have to out-organize them. Okay, good, that's a good thing. Yay! Okay, Kathy, and then they're gonna fill me up. Go ahead.
Hi, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the vice president of independentvoting.org, and I just wanted to share a couple of thoughts. One thing I think that's so important, the theme that you were raising, Lenora, about when people say to you, can this work? And you say,
I don't know, but we have to do this. I think that the country is having an experience right now of A, the things that we thought were supposed to work don't work. B, I think we're living through a very profound shift, and I'm so glad you shared that clip of Fred talking about normalcy, because I think that normal
has changed.
We don't know what that is, and that's the best thing that could have happened to this country.
Yeah,
and I really think what you're saying and what Art is raising, we have to go talk to people who don't talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We have to talk to Trump voters. We have to talk to our liberal friends who are feeling very frightened by this moment. As Americans, unmediated by the political parties that want to demonize one side or the other, we just saw what that got us.
Mm-hmm.
I also was thinking on the way over here, I read an article in my internet news feed today about $771 million that Governor Cuomo has found for Mayor de Blasio to build affordable housing. And of course, the cutoff, the bottom line of that is you have to make $25,000 a year. I just think there's so much misinformation, and the size and scope of the problem is just being covered over, and especially around next gen.
Yes.
I think that the work that everybody in this room has been doing or will do from tonight to have conversations in every community of our city and to raise what's happening with NextGen and the importance of petitioning and witnessing and standing with our communities and also the political power question.
Mm-hmm.
How could it be in New York City that this isn't an issue we can shape? Why can't we do that? And what are we going to have to do to create a political culture that can do that? That's the question that we work on every day in independent voting. Just a little interesting side note, and I think it's helpful, a perspective that I have as an independent. Independents are a real swing force in this country, searching, fighting, looking for a way to get something new created. We were Barack Obama's margin of victory in alliance with the African American community and young people in 2008 in the primaries and then in the general election. And we were Donald Trump's margin of victory, not me. Independents were his margin of victory in those Rust Belt swing states. So that tells me that there's a constituency of Americans out there that are like a battering ram. They're trying to find a crack. They're trying to find a way for the light that is the hope of American people coming together. And those independents, we're diverse. We're black, we're white, we're young, we're old. We cut across all these categories. But there's something that happened in this election season that there's no answer.
Yes.
The only question, but it's about time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel really just thrilled to be here for people mm-hmm. who are willing to ask mm-hmm. hard questions.
Can she say, okay, you have like 1 minute because they're shooting darts at me.
Have you ever shot a dart at your
wife? I'm Diana. I was raised in Ohio. I call it KK Country, USA. I'm an advocate. I just spent the last 2 days with the National Women Political Caucus. There's a 3-day conference. And when we're talking about the election, housing, and all the other issues, I heard there were Republican speakers, Independent, Green Party, and of course, Jill Stein was there today. Okay? I'm really trying to get to a solution, and everyone is trying to get to a solution. Where are we going to go from here, and how are we going to organize to make sure that we reflect the human rights to everyone, black, white, no matter what. Housing is a big problem across this country. Okay, that's number one. People are looking for solutions, and there were some young people there, they were speaking out, and they're crying and begging for solutions. They don't know what to do, they don't know where to go. And my bottom line is education. I know there's 50,000 kids in the Department of Education are homeless, going through the homeless. Our homeless going through the DOE. People want solutions. How are we going to get there? I rally for the housing. I go to Albany. I go to Washington. And all of the issues. And I'm on my local Democratic Party, which we do resolutions for housing anyway, for middle class and for the NYCHA, and we all together. So what is the solution? And I really like the independent, what you're saying, but how do you organize to reach the masses? Because people right now want an answer and a solution. And okay. I don't care okay. what their age group or what have you. And what I've heard in all the groups, and I'm in all, and I go to a lot of meetings.
I got a solution.
They need a solution. Get it out to let people know.
Well, first of all, you're going to talk to Kathy about the independent issues. But to me, I'm a maverick. That's probably a nice way of saying it. there is no solution. What there is people rolling up their sleeves, stepping out, and doing some things that change what's going on, that impact whatever the situation is. Because, and we have to do that together. So there are probably tons of things we could do. I think collecting petition signatures is important. I think speaking to people, having these conversations is important. I think people dealing with whatever their emotional or subjective responses to what's going on in the world is important. And I think people should get together and talk and figure out what they want to do. And we have a list of things. I'll give you my card. There's always something to do. Collect signatures, which isn't just collecting signatures. It's also having a conversation with people about what it is that you're doing. You can build your own group. People can. And I mean, I don't feel freaked out. I'm more some combination. I feel very loving towards the American people, and like I want to throw down with them. I have no idea what that means. And I'm very upset with the people who run this country. So I'm going to hang out with the American people. And we're going to build something. We're going to keep building up this thing we've always built. And that's what we have to do. There is no quick fix, I wish. And then I would go to Jamaica and lay on the beach. Anyway, thank you all. Love you. Yay!